Succession number 27058, Reel 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Rod Ulrich in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 26th of the 12th, 2003, with the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Rob, I was wanting to talk about how the loss of someone would affect the squadron.
The main effect of somebody being shot down caused a level of depression amongst the pilots. The depression was most noticeable amongst those people who shared a tent with a fellow who had been shot down. But after a while, the depression seemed to be lifted because they were still there to do a job. And because somebody had been shot down, that wasn't really unusual. It's a matter of luck when you go out or when you come back as to Germans firing at you with anti-aircraft. It's just a matter of luck whether you're hit or not.
But did it bring the reality, presumably, back to you that you weren't?
Oh, yes, particularly in those fellows who shared a tent with the chap. You'd notice they were down in the mouth for 3 or 4 days. But after about a week, I'd say, everything went back to normal.
Let's talk about your experience in relation to your duties and what they included up until the time of, as you mentioned earlier on, May of 43.
Well, that was the time when the war in the desert actually came to an end. We were based at a place called El Kerouan, which was just somewhat south of Tunis. And the Germans did what was came to be called Wehrmacht Dunkirk. They did everything they could to get out of Tunis, and we used to fly along the beaches. And we killed them in there, thousands, thousands and thousands. They took extraordinary lengths and extraordinary risks to get away any way they could, but they were massacred. It was probably one of the biggest defeats for the German army, I would think, in many, many years.
Can you describe that that to us a little bit more? You mentioned, obviously, flying along the beaches. Can you just give us the picture?
Well, there'd be thousands and thousands and thousands of Germans on the beach waiting for any transport that would get them out to sea. But they didn't have a great deal of help because we were in total control of the air, what was called air superiority. And it follows pretty well conclusively that if you have what is known as air superiority, you've got control of almost everything. Because if a head pops up, you just blow it off. And they had very little to fight back with. Their roof off, I think, was, in those days, pretty well damaged, almost beyond repair. They had very few serviceable aeroplanes. And they did everything they could and anything they could to get away. But thousands of them never made it.
So what would your duties entail, flying over the beaches?
Just strafing anything we saw that was a target. People, trucks carrying people, small craft carrying people.
How are you able to put yourself in a position, okay, well, I'm now flying a plane and I'm purposefully shooting at people on the ground who are pretty well defenceless?
Good for us. Very good for us. I don't think anybody had any sympathy for the Germans who behaved in slightly barbaric manner while they were in the desert. Murder, rape and pillage was uppermost in the German mind, and they gave very little quarter or very little mercy to anybody who upset them. And this could have been regarded as retribution.
In relation to being a pilot, to what degree is there an isolation from the damage that's happening on the ground?
Well, if you're in the air and they're on the ground, you have got a very definite advantage. And the art of warfare is trying to get an advantage over the enemy.
But Did you mention you mentioned that? I'm more interested in the actual, for the individual, being a pilot. It's actually an easier job being in that situation, because you're not actually experiencing the horror on the ground that you might actually be creating. But you're not that close to it to understand what's going on.
No, but you always face a very good chance of being shot down, because the Germans were very, very, very disciplined. And one thing we learned, and I think we were told by our chief, can't think of the word, intelligence officer, a fellow called George Barton, that the Germans, if they knew they were about to be strafed, hundreds of them would just lie down flat on their back and point their rifles in the air and fire the rifles as you went over. And of course, that would be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bullets flying up. And it only takes one in the radiator or the fuel tank or the oil tank, and you're definitely disadvantaged. And we had to put up with that. But then again, if you're in an aeroplane that's travelling at 230, 240 miles an hour, you've got to be unlucky to be shot down under those conditions, but it can happen.
In relation to other duties involved?
There were in those days, there were no other duties really. Other than flying an aeroplane.
In this, you were strafing, you mentioned. What of other duties actually flying at this time?
Bombing. We did a lot of bombardments in the trying to scuttle or damage any ships that may have come along. I was flying number two to a fellow called John Hook, who only died about 6 months ago. And Hookie was a very, very good pilot. And as the number two, my job was to follow what number one did, being John Hook. And he went into a steep dive, so I followed him. And he dropped, well, I think we were carrying two 250-pound bombers in those days. And I saw him dive on a ship, and he missed it by a fraction. And I dived and I aimed my bombs at the ship and I missed it by a fraction. And when we got back, we were both carpeted because, unfortunately, it was a hospital ship. But I didn't see the hospital sign on it because I was right above and the hospital cross was on the side of the ship. But we both went before Billy Burton, who was the wing commander of 239 Wing, and we got a strip torn off us for bombing a hospital ship. Which I thought was a bit funny. We were trying to beat these so-and-so and so-and-sos. But Billy Burt was a good bloke. Once he had his say, was all forgotten. He never came back to haunt you. But he just rocketed both Hookie and myself for bombing us. And Hookie said, "Oh, I'm sorry, sure, I didn't see the sign," which could have been true. But Hookie was a bloke who didn't like Germans, so whether it was true or not, I don't know, and I wasn't silly enough to inquire.
But did you understand what was going on in the greater sort of plan of...
I'm not sure that I did. I knew what was going on where we were in the desert, but we were doing what we were told to do, what we were there to do. Well, all I understood was the Germans were there, and our aim was to get rid of them one way or another, any way we could. I mean in my opinion, if you've got an enemy, I mean, how you kill him, I don't think really matters as much. That's what you're there for, is to exercise control, supreme control over the enemy, and make it impossible for him to disable you. That's the aim of warfare, to be better than the other bloke.
How long would your duties to attack the enemy take during the average day?
Oh, probably about 45 minutes. Because we were at El Caraway, which was only a short distance away. So by the time you flew, it would be about 45 minutes. Sometimes maybe an hour.
And what would you do for the rest of the time?
Write letters. Go and have a talk with the crew of your aeroplane, see if they've found anything wrong with it. Yeah.
I get the impression that a lot of warfare is 95% to 99%. Boredom and sort of 1% action.
Well, the Americans put it very succinctly. War is a very great deal of hurry up and wait. I don't think I was ever bored, no. Well, as soon as one flight took off, you knew that you were in the next flight, and that depended on when the earlier flights returned were refueled and rearmed, which would take probably an hour and a half. So once those boats came back, you knew you were off in about an hour and a half. I don't think anyone knew was ever bored, because we were fighting a very determined enemy. It was our good fortune that we had more in the ways of warfare equipment and armament than they did at that time.
You mentioned General Montgomery.
Yep.
What have you heard of General Alexander? Tell us about General Alexander.
Well, we knew that he was the senior British Army officer in North Africa at the time, and we knew he was Irish, and everyone that I spoke to said he was a bloody marvellous man. We were told, I don't think this is generally known, I don't think, that he was given the responsibility of the mass evacuation of Dunkirk. And we were told by a lot of people that he was the very last person to leave the beach at Dunkirk after he got everybody else out. And he was a very popular man. He was a very nice bloke to talk to. He spoke to everybody exactly the same. I think he spent about 2 days with us. I can't quite think where we were. Can't think. We were then Ilkirawan. I can't remember the place before Ilkirawan. He was only there for about 2 days. But what he did, he was very natural sort of a fellow. And he walked into the mess one morning, and he went to a chair and says, "Is this anyone's chair? Or can I use that for?" Over to you, sir. No, but I'm not taking him as poor. No, okay. But the adjutant came up to see him, and we had an adjutant who wasn't too bloody bright in those days. In fact, thinking back at it, I think one of the qualifications to be an adjutant was not too bloody bright in the first place. And he said, "Oh, I'll send a man with you, sir." And he looked at him and said, "Oh, it's all right. I can find a way around the desert. I've got a map and a compass and everything." Oh. So he just wandered off, and he'd walk up to people who were working on aircraft and ask them what they were doing and what would happen if they hadn't done what they had done and what would happen and so and so and so and so. And he'd go and have breakfast one morning in the airman's mess, and he'd go and have lunch with the sergeant's mess, and he'd go back to the airman's mess for dinner at night, and the next day he'd go to the sergeant's mess. And he just got on with everything because he's such a pleasant fellow. And he was just... good manners just flowed over him like a river under flood. He was just a thoroughly nice man. He had a very quiet way of speaking, spoke the same to everybody. A very pleasant fellow.
The fact that they were able to make contact with the average soldier, how did that make them different from those that the higher mighty, as it were?
Well, a lot of British officers were not always easy to get on with junior ranks, and a lot of Australian senior officers that I know of or knew of, they were always not easy to get along with junior ranks. They seemed to think that as they went up the promotion ladder, that made them better and better and better than the ordinary person who hadn't gone up in the equivalent way. But Alexander was just very good to everybody, just super polite to everybody. If he didn't see the bloody crossed swords and thin crowns on his shoulders, you thought he was a Salvation Army bloke collecting money for the poor. He was a thoroughly nice bloke.
You had a story about Alexander, and when he was asked what he was doing in one of the...
Oh, yes. This was... what was it? He'd just been made a field marshal, I think. And he... of course, he belonged to a club in London. I mean, everybody in London who doesn't belong to a club is pretty much on the outskirts. And apparently somebody knew Alexander one day and just said, I think his name was Renouf, an unusual name. Said to him, "What are you doing these days, old chap?" And he said, "Oh, still soldiering on, old chap." And he just made a field marshal. Typical Alexander.
I'm interested that the memories of a popular general are still... touch you even today when you recall them. Mm. At the time, how important was it for men to have leaders like that?
Oh, vital. Absolutely vital. If you haven't got good military leaders, you haven't got a good army.
What were some of those leaders, or who were some of those leaders that stuck up that didn't do what you felt?
Wavell was one who fell foul.
Why was that?
No one knows. He just didn't seem to function in the army, in the desert for some reason. I think they sent him into Greece, and I don't think he went well there. Then Claude Auchinleck, I think, was took over after Wavell, and he upset somebody, and he didn't last long. And then we got Montgomery. And Montgomery was a practicing, very, very practicing Methodist.
You mentioned Montgomery earlier. Mm. What of Blaney? Did you know anything of Blaney?
Not really. I don't think he was as good as he was cracked up to be by the Australian press. There was a story told about General Blamey. Just after the war, he was made Commissioner of Police in Victoria. And one evening, this is after the war, when he was no longer in the army, a very significant house of ill repute was raided in one of Melbourne's Tonia suburbs, and a lot of fleeing figures got away, but unfortunately they found a police badge, and the police badge turned out to be the property of the Commissioner of Police, and it was hushed up, I believe, very, very, very seriously hushed up. But I knew some blokes in the army who had met Blamey, and they didn't like him at all.
I wanted you to tell us the story in relation to the takeover of Tunis, the Germans having fled, as you mentioned earlier, in the Wehrmacht Dunkirk, about how you went to Tunis, particularly the story about the car.
Well, we were told one day at breakfast that there was a list on the board of pilots who were available for leave. And my name was on it, with a great friend of mine called Bill Leach. Unfortunately, Bill was killed a few years ago. Bill was a strange fellow in many ways. He was a terribly handsome bloke, Bill, very handsome. He was half Greek, and he was very involved in my relationship with young Irini Noitakis. Bill's father had been in the Light Horse in the First World War, met a little Greek girl in Alex, and he took her back to Australia, and she became Mrs. Leeds, and then Bill was born. And Bill could speak Greek, or a little bit of Greek, and he told me a few phrases I should speak to Irini, and a few phrases that I should not speak to Irini. So he put me on the right tramp of saying the right thing, and avoiding saying the wrong thing to a 17-year-old Greek girl. And he was very helpful in that little romance, very helpful indeed. So Bill and I went off on leave, and we all clambered on the back of a flat 3-ton truck. There was about 8 of us going on leave, I think. So off we went at some speed. And I can't remember how far El Kerouan was from Tunis, probably 70 or 80 miles, I suppose. And we're tooling along at quite some pace, and all of a sudden there was a ginormous bang in the back of the truck, and the dual rear wheels, each tyre had burst at the same time, and of course the truck slewed all over the place, and the driver got out looking a bit sorry for himself and his oppo, and he said, "Fellas, this is going to take an hour and a half to 2 hours to fix the bloody mess, so, you know, wander off and come back in about an hour and a half." So we found that we were in a huge orange orchard, and the trees were laden with oranges. So in the days of the desert, I don't remember seeing a piece of fruit, not even tinned that I can remember. So Bill and I and everybody is just walking around, filling up pockets and shirts and all sort of things with oranges and eating en route. And we found that we were opposite what was called an REME unit. There was the Royal Engineers and Mechanical Engineers unit, which was the place for repairing army vehicles which required repair. And we were just looking at this and taking not much notice. And up drove the prettiest little motor car I'd ever seen in my life. It was very low to the ground. It was quite long. I don't know what it was. It would have been 34, 30 feet long. It was a Peugeot two-seater with magnificent red upholstery and more instruments on the instrument panel than my bloody kitty hawk. And this car stops in front of this Remy, and out gets a bloke who could have stepped out of Carl Meyer's Christmas window. He was a one pipper, a second lieutenant. You could have shaved with the creases in his trousers, and you could have used the shine in his shoes as a mirror. And he looked us up and down. Of course, Bill and I were a bit scruffy. We probably had to shave for a few days. And there was no water in the desert, so nobody ever had a wash. We washed all our clothes with petrol, which had a few disadvantages until you got used to it. And he just looked us up and down in a most sort of disarming manner. I don't think he actually said bloody colonials, but Bill and I were sure that's how he felt, so we thought we got to teach this bastard a lesson. So he got out of his car, walked through the gate, and set up the path to go to this office in the Remy. Unfortunately for us, the distance between the front gate and the office was a couple of hundred yards, I think. And Bill, who knew a great deal about cars, said, "Listen to me, Robert, pay attention. This car does not have an electric ignition system, so you don't need a key to start it. This has got a magneto switch. And my best is to that big black knob, and then that's it. So all you've got to do is turn it a bit either way, and the engine is live. And being warm, my best, it'll start like hell. What do you reckon? Let's go, Bill." So we piled in, and Bill turned the thing, pressed the start, and off we went. And the people who told us later on that one pepper nearly had a bit of a fit. And they sent two blokes on motorcycles after us, who we never saw. And they also sent a little Saracen after us. And the Saracen in those days was a small, about two or three man tank, fitted, I believe, with the V12 Rolls-Royce engines. But we didn't see him either. Bill drove like a bloody wind. Oh, boy. He was a good driver, Bill. So we went like bloody hell for, I don't know, an hour and a half. And we stopped on the top of a hill and looked back and couldn't see anybody. And Bill said, "Well, we got it. What do we do with it?" And I said, "Well, you tell me, Bill. You're a pilot officer. I'm only a sergeant." And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what we'll do. A car like this would be obvious. It would be picked out very easily if we were in Actuchiris. That's probably where it came from. So my idea is to give Tunis a miss for 3 or 4 days and see what we can come up with an idea of keeping this car sort of hidden from prying eyes." "Okay, Bill, I'm with you." So we went to a place called Bon or Bone, I think it was, which is in the North African coast, a few miles to the west of Tunis. And to me, one Arab town is exactly the same as another Arab town. So we went to Bon, and we stayed there for a couple of days, and there wasn't much to see, so we went somewhere else, Constantine, I think it might have been, for another couple of days. And we looked around there, and it wasn't much fun, so we were getting short of money, which was a bit sad. So Bill said, "What are we going to do, Robert? We'll go back into Tunis early one morning, and somehow we'll camouflage the car." And I said, "Bill, how the bloody hell do you camouflage a bright yellow sports Peugeot in a busy bloody city?" And Bill said, "I'm still working on that one, but that's what we'll do." So, "Okay, Bill." He said, "Now we'll leave here, so we'll get into Tunis nice and early. So it'll give us a chance to find out where we can conceal this car." "Okay, Bill." So we left Constantine, whatever time we had to, or before sunrise. We got into Tunis about, 60s, I think, thereabouts. And we were in the western side of the city, which is a very old part of the city. Tunis, as far as I know, is hundreds of years old. Might be even be thousands, I can't remember. And we were driving down streets that were very narrow. We found out later on that when that part of the city had been built, streets were only made wide enough for two donkeys to pass, that was all. So we're snaking down these very narrow streets. Of course, there are no signs we could read. And all of a sudden, Bill said, "For God's sake, look at that." And there's a huge enamel sign on a wall. "Peugeot Experts. Servicing. Spare parts. Reconditioning. Our name is your guarantee of satisfaction. Inquire within." We all said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, it's you. I never talked to this fella. So we parked the car half on the street and half on the footpath and went in. And there was a little fat bloke in a pair of overalls and a beret on, and he was the exact copy of Agatha Christie's legendary Belgian detective Hercule Poirot. I mean, he could have been his father. So Bill and I, we've got Australia flash of things which we have to wear on our shoulders in those days. And he walks and he says, ah, Australia, Australia. Good, I am French myself. We are allies from the First World War. Well, we both fought the hated Bosch. He spat on the floor just from him. He said, how can I serve you, gentlemen? And Bill said, well, we've got a little Peugeot sports car and the ammeter is not working terribly well. We'd like to know if you... He said, oh, it is but a trice, it is but a trice. First we will have coffee and cognac. Oh, that's all right. I wasn't too wrapped in the coffee, but the cognac sounded okay. So he poured us a cup of coffee and a glass of cognac, which we had. And he said, well, bring in the automobile, gentlemen, and then I shall repair it in a trice. So Bill said to me, Robert, you stop it. You can stop in and slop up the cognac. I'll bring the car in. So right, Bill. And I'm chatting with this little French bloke. And never forget this. Bill drove the car in. And I've never seen such a change in a person in my life, this little French bloke. He was holding his little coffee cup. It was going like that. It was about as Salvation Army people with castanets all over the place. And he went as white as a sheet. And he started to shake. And he looked at Bill and I again and looked at their shoulders up. And he said, honoured sirs, please understand, it is not my intention to give offence. We were allies in the First World War against the Red and Bosch. And I am not giving offence, but may I ask, without offence, how you come to be in possession of this particular vehicle? And Bill telling a story that nobody would have believed. And he said, we will have more coffee and cognac. So we filled up our coffee cups and our glasses. He said, I will tell you a story about this car, which will not only be very interesting, on it says, but it may save your life. Well, of course, it's one thing that Bill and I were interested in, was saving of lives. And he said, this car was once the property of the most hated man, not only in Tunis, but in all Tunisia. He was a colonel, something he pronounced an Italian name, I can't remember. But he said he was in charge of the Italian secret police and was known to be a man of great evil. And anybody who upset this man usually vanished very quickly and was not normally known to reappear again anywhere. He was a man of great evil and much hatred. Everybody was frightened of him. But he said he was a man of great habit, and he had himself 6 or 7 mistresses round the city, and he was a person of habit. And one night there was a meeting of people who wished him evil. It was decided that they should waylay him when he was coming back from one of his favourite mistresses one night and kill him. And we said, oh yeah. So he said it was all arranged that on the way back from this mistress's house, somebody would park a large truck behind a big building, and all the streets in that area are very narrow. So it was arranged that somebody would sit on a rooftop, and when they saw the lights coming back this way, it would be presumed to be the colonel. So a signal would be made, and somebody would drive the truck from behind the building right in the centre of the road and stop it and run away. So the colonel would have no option but to stop his car. It was too narrow for him to turn round. And when he did that, there were several figures behind buildings and old trees. They came out and pulled him out of the car and hacked him to death with swords and axes. I said, well, that'll just about do it if that's what you've got your mind set on doing. That'll work very well. And he said, now, if anybody sees you two driving around the city and that, they may mistake you for his own comrades or something, and you might be dealt with in the same manner. So let me propose a suggestion to you. We'll have more coffee and cognac. So off he trotted and came back. And he said, to fix the ammeter, but a trice, 5 minutes. I will do that. I will then put your car in this corner and cover with a large tarpaulin. You have your leave. And when you finish, you come back, take your car, and off you go. So we said, oh, that's very kind. He said, don't talk. We were allies in the First World War. So Bill and I walked off. We were only about 10 minutes from the centre of Tunis, and then we saw another sign, which was even better than the first sign. This one said, RAF, paymaster, inquire within. And Bill and I were short of money. And we inquired with him and came across a very, very fat RAF bloke. And he said, "Ah, two of our colonial boys," endearing him to himself heartily. He said, "What can I do for you fellas?" And he said, "Well, we're just arrived for a few days' leave, sir, and we get an advance on our pay." "Of course, of course, of course. I can let you have £10 right away." And Bill and I said, "Well, we're going to have about 12 days' leave here, sir, and £10 isn't going to go all that far." And he said, "Well, we'll have a drink and talk it over." So I thought, "Oh, well, that's all right." So we yelled out something in a foreign tongue, and a very pretty little Arab girl poked her head round the corner, and he yelled out something to her, and she vanished. And I thought, "Oh, big bottle of something." And she came back with a tray and a huge enamel teapot, three mugs, and something that held some sugar in it, and some dry biscuits. Oh, boy. So we told him a few good stories, and we finally got £250 sterling each from him in, I think, lira was the currency in Tunis in those days. So we went off and had a very good leave. We met up with a few other blokes. We went to the best hotel in Tunis. I can't think what it was called in those days. But we really went to town on the food.